Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's just used a biro in the dressing room, which someone else's spit came out of and leaked onto the page he was writing with. But whose spit was it? I don't know. It's Richard Herring! Thank you very much. Hello! Welcome. Welcome. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was hanging out with the lady from the Shaken Vac advert the other day, and I have a feeling I might have done it with her before in this context. She doesn't even use Shaken Vac when she vacuums. She just vacuums, like, normally. I mean, why would you put more stuff on the floor? It was a bad idea. Anyway, she calls it Rehlestapa. So, that was quite nasty. I was just writing notes about Al Murray. See that slight state? That's someone else's spit. But whose spit is it? It could be Maria Bamford's spit, which wouldn't be a bad thing. But it could be, like, there was like a sketch show competition here. Yes, it could be someone who does sketches. That's a terrible thing. I may have been infected. You don't know, do you? But, you know, so someone in showbiz has probably got some kind of disease in it. So I've been reading the news, which isn't much use to you people listening at home, because I think it's about June now at home. The week this was recorded, they were talking about the passports, the contract having gone to France, which has annoyed the contract for the blue passports. They're going to be made in France, which is kind of quite funny, isn't it? People get annoyed about it, but I say, how about the blue passports get made in France and the burgundy ones get made in the UK, and then we get to choose which ones we want to have based on how patriotic we are. No, I think it'd be hard, wouldn't it? Do you want the blue one from France or the burgundy one from the UK? Oh. Then all the new kit people will explode and we can go back to being in Europe. So that'll be good. I've been very busy this week and next week coming on the tour. I've been to Glasgow twice this week. Very lovely shows, both of them. I did John Maloney's... got hair all over me, sorry. It's not... I think it's my Wookiee book. It's hard to tell, isn't it, which one's the more hairy. John Maloney, who we had on, and we talked about that idea of doing the live at the Apollo, Dead at the Apollo for over 50s. That happened this week. He recorded 6 episodes of that fantastic show with lots of comedians over 50, which I just snuck into. I was basically the kid in the room. I really love the Glasgow shows. And then I did my stand-up show, annoyingly, on the Friday. So I was on that. I was in Glasgow on Tuesday and Friday. And had to go to Colchester and Market Drayton in between. And Market Drayton, I thought, was just a place where puppets lived that was voiced by Brian Kent. But I was apparently it's a real place. But I love the Glasgow audience. And I was thinking, the first time I went up to Glasgow was in the Oxford Review in 1988. And we were very nervous as English little posh kids going up, supposedly posh kids going up to Glasgow. And no one came, really. And we went down to silence, actually. And then it was the week that the two people in the show came up to us after, the two of the audience members came and talked to us afterwards and said, "You should have done more jokes about Piper Alpha," which had just happened that week, which was where like 170 people had died in a fire on an oil rig. So, yeah, I think that would have probably swung it for us, wouldn't it, if we'd just come on with that? But now, everyone loves me in Glasgow because I talk in their language. That is the thing, and that is the... They love me up there. So anyway, the John Maloney show is great. I also played in Warsaw. I've now been to Warsaw, Indiana, Warsaw, UK, but I haven't been to Warsaw, Poland. But once I've done that, then I've been to, I'm guessing, the 3 worst places in the world. And Warsaw, UK, is worse than Warsaw, Indiana. That's how bad it was. No offence to anyone from Warsaw. Thanks for coming. It was a lovely show. I was at a place called the Forest Arts. Oh, this is going to be nice. It was literally a fucking aircraft hangar in the middle of some dilapidated buildings. I mean, I don't know how it got the name the Forest Arts. There must have been a forest that they knocked down to build Warsaw. Anyway, thanks for having me in Warsaw. I will go on. We're going to crack on. So our first guest tonight, I mean, the only guest this week is... Nearly gave the game away there, David. Just covered myself at the last minute. You're much better than last week's audience, I'll tell you that right now. She is probably best known for appearing on the show When Game Shows Go Horribly Wrong. That is usually when Richard Herring is on them, trying to win them. We please welcome Desiree Birch, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Sit down. Pull up a microphone. Oh my goodness. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Yeah. Those game shows went horribly, horribly wrong. Someone had to let you guys know.
Yeah. What kind of things went horribly wrong in the game shows?
I don't know. One of the hosts was a pedophile. That's okay. A thing. It's pretty bad.
During the actual game show, though?
No, but he was massively creepy. Like, he was Trump and a little extra creepy. Okay. So, like, yeah.
I think I've seen that clip of that guy.
Yeah. He's like a lot of back rubbing. Yeah.
It was a different time back then. Men could
rub anyone.
Flirt and kiss with children on TV.
Yes.
Yeah, good. I was thinking, you know, when I got knocked out of Pointless by 2 points, that would be going horribly wrong. But no, that probably is... That's...
I like
really want a Pointless trophy. I mean, if it comes to it, if they say this is the only way you're going to get one, Rich. Oh. No, I wouldn't do that. So,
you've never gotten any other kind of trophy that you'd do that
I've
for the trophy.
I've never got any. Well, I've got the Chortle Internet. I've got about 10 Chortle Internet awards, but
there you go.
What use are those? Can't even chuck them on the fire. They don't burn. So you've got awards. You won the Funny Woman Award, Women Award.
Yes, I did. A couple of years ago, 2015.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's hear your story a little bit. So you've come over from America. In America, you were doing a lot of theatre.
Yeah. I still do theatre, but I was doing a lot more like one-woman shows, device theatre, that kind of stuff. Did some stand-up. But, I mean, there are various ways not to get paid, especially when you're working as an artist in New York. I tried many of them, enjoyed doing that, and then moved over here.
What brought you to the UK?
Oh, boy.
Oh.
No, we broke up recently, so don't get too romantic about it. But we were together for like 3.5 years. It was like a legit relationship. But yes, that's the reason I moved. Because I was in New York, and I just, I'd been there for so long. I was there for 13 years, and like somewhere around between like year 5 and 8, you start going like, I need to get out of here. Like, this is no kind of life. I need to get out of here. And you say that for at least 5 years before you do anything. And so it was just like this window opened, and I was like, I'm in love. Let's go do the thing I never left time to do because I was too busy working for cheap. So, yeah.
And so did you plan to come and work here? You sort of thought, let's see how the theater and stand-up goes in the UK, or is this...
Yeah, I mean, I had done Edinburgh a couple of times with a theater piece, and so, you know, I'd met people. I clearly enjoyed that sort of scenario. Like, I was just like, oh, everyone here goes and sees live theater and comedy and performance all the time. This is like a utopia. Let's go. And so, you know, when I met this person, I was like, okay, yeah, like, let's do it. Moved over, and then I had to figure out how to get a visa because I desperately did not want to get deported. Like, I think I saw Border Force on day 2, and I was like, oh, no! like, they pumped it in specifically because they knew where I was staying.
So, well, did you grow up in California, though?
I did, yes.
So, I saw you talking. We do some TED Talks and some NerdCon talks.
Yeah.
So I saw you talking about growing up.
Yeah.
And you, so your background, you're saying you're quite middle class.
Yeah.
But not that well off.
Yeah, no, so we were...
Does middle class mean different in...
Yeah, I was confused when I got here, because I was like, oh, this is middle class. And I was like, that person's fucking rich. Like, I don't know what you're talking about, middle class. Like, in America, everybody thinks they're middle class, even though they're poor. Like, they can't admit or ever be told that they're poor, because they're on their way. So there's, like, a wide bracket, unless you know, because you live in a certain area or it looks like something, you're poor. And so, you know, we moved to... Especially in Southern California, there are all of these suburban towns that they just kept building tract homes in, and they all look exactly the same. And so if you moved out there at the right time, it was just, I mean, seriously, I go to the place where my mom lives now, and I'm at the traffic light, and there's like a Target there and a Walgreens there, and there's a tumbleweed going across the street. Like, that's how just raw and new everything is that they keep excavating and building there. So yeah, my parents moved to this, you know, town, the suburban town, like when I was 6 months old, out of Los Angeles. And that's where I grew up. Yeah, it was super, like, we were clearly the, like, black people on our block who were poor. But, like, we still, you know, like, yeah, grew up in a middle-class area.
Yeah, because you were saying in one of the talks that you really want to learn the piano.
Yeah,
your parents just laughed in your face.
Yes, oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it was, I would say, after... after sort of white people, the next sort of majority was like East Asian, Korean, and Chinese predominantly. And so I went to school with a lot of kids who were like getting piano lessons from like the womb almost, you know? And so like everybody had this sort of ability to do music and that kind of thing. And I was like, I want to do that. I was, you know, one of these nerdy kids. So I hung out with other nerdy kids and I wanted to do like cool musical nerdy kid stuff. And they were just like, that's never happening. When did she ask for a piano? Like, it was a running joke.
Because I am middle class in a UK sense, although my parents were teachers. We didn't have much. I did have piano lessons.
Jealous.
And I really hated it. I didn't want to go, and it made me feel bad that I could have just sent my piano lessons to you. I hated it. I did piano lessons about 5 years and hated every second of it.
But like, if there's a piano in a room, you can walk up to it and just go like, oh, la la,
no.
And like everyone's like,
no, no, I can't. Because I was terrible. And I didn't practice at all. If I managed to, I went in one to the house once and I couldn't find the piano teacher, just so pretended that. And I didn't look that hard, and then I just went home and said they weren't there.
Even though the door was wide open and I heard a faucet running.
So it makes me feel, suddenly I look back and go, that was, you know, very ungrateful of me when you were there.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't be anything but ungrateful when you're a kid. Because you just show up and you're like, I didn't ask to be here, and you're not giving me what I want. And everything kind of sucks, and I can't wait until I'm older. You know, at least that's the way I was. Like, I always thought, like, oh, I can't wait until I'm older and my life's my own, and I get to do everything I want to do, because that's what you think it is. Yeah. And then you grow up and you're just like, oh, I just want to look at clouds. And, you know, yeah, no time.
It's cool being a kid, you know, and that is it's a shame that you want to get away from it. I even feel like my 3-year-old's a bit like that. She seems to want to grow up, and you go, no, this is good, enjoy it. Say poo more. I don't really need to encourage
I mean, she can continue saying poo.
She will, she does. She doesn't, she will. And you went to Yale.
I did.
Yeah. When you say that in America, everyone cheers.
Ooh. No, I barely say it because the problem is, like, you know, like people go like, oh, where did you go to college? And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, I was in Connecticut or like I studied New Haven or whatever. And like people just sort of like leave it there because you don't want to be responsible for everything that means, because as soon as you get something wrong, they're like, oh, Yale doesn't know the answer to this one. And you're like, dude, I'm a human being. I don't know that thing. Also, George W. Bush went to Yale. So like, let's keep the bar where, you know. Let's make it fair. Right?
I fancy he might have had some financial help. From
yeah.
The that you may, that I'd reckon he could have had piano lessons. If he
I bet. I mean, whatever. He's painting all the time. I'm sure he did have piano lessons. I'm sure he's a regular Picasso when he's not being a war criminal.
He liked to drink, didn't he? Yeah. So he probably wouldn't have been able to play the piano. Well, let's have a look at some of your work. So you did one of your theatre shows, I think, was Tar Baby. That's,
yes.
So what was that about?
So it's one of those things that, like, you say it in America, everybody knows exactly what it's about. It's a show about race and capitalism in America. So it's, you know, that's one of, it's like a very old-timey racist term, Tar Baby. And I love taking things that people are like, well, you can't talk about that, and being like, fucking watch me. So it was this interactive carnival of race and capitalism. So there are all these carnival-esque games, and I'm the Barker, and it's all about the selling and the packaging of the narrative that supports racism, you know, the narratives that we continue to tell ourselves and our children about, you know, what is true about certain people when ultimately those stories are made up so that people can make money hand over fist off of those people and feel good about it because they don't consider them to be, you know, people or equal to them in any way.
Sure.
So, you know, like we'd have like test your strength against racism, and there was like a big test your strength, and people would come up and like have to refute, you know, racist statements or you know, rationalize them or try to reckon with them, you know, and it's great because, you know, you slowly start to bring people in and kind of make them feel like we're all in this together. It's not about, you know, like pointing fingers and blaming anybody. And that's usually like the sort of knee-jerk reaction that people have that makes them unwilling to engage in further conversation. Whereas if you can kind of go like, look, we're all part of a racist society. So like, it would be weird if you weren't racist. Cause like, how did you manage to grow up that way in the society we're in? So like, let's just talk about it. So it is the sort of slow motion of getting people like more interactive, more involved in the conversation that happens in the space.
Sure.
And then of course, you know, I've got to like yell and scream at the end just to make them feel like they got their money's worth. They're like, wow, that black lady sure got angry. Wow, that was important. We're going to write them. Yeah. So anyway.
Well, it's sort of astounding, it seems to be getting worse again in America, the racial tensions and the racial issues and racism. Let's just say that. In that the president of the United States seems to be quite racist.
Yes, exactly. Yes, and seems to represent a very outspoken contingent of people who feel emboldened by him. I think that, I mean, it is astounding in some ways that it's coming back, but it's not because it didn't go anywhere.
Right.
I think it just seemed like it did. There were these like lovely veneers that we put on, but we actually didn't sort of change things that are at the root of these problems. Like for me, I felt like education is a big one, not only like access to, you know, like adequate kind of education, but the way, you know, just simply the way the history books are constructed and the narratives that we tell ourselves about, you know, who's good and who's bad and why it all happened. And I feel like, you know, I definitely sat in a lot of classrooms as we were studying slavery, as you would do in an American classroom, because it's like the only history we have. Like, it's like that and like the Monroe Doctrine, and then like JFK got shot, and then it's like the rest of the, you know, Billy Joel song, you know, but like most of it is slavery, right? I guess that would have been a downer way to start that song. But like, you know, so it's, you know, I mean, I definitely sat in those classrooms and, you know, there is this narrative, like we don't have hear any of their voices or about their humanity whatsoever. So it's just pictures of like people being beaten or swinging from trees. And then everyone in class is like, oh, that's you, you know, because I'm the other black kid in this advanced placement class because I'm the one, you know, and that's. Yeah, and there's nobody there to correct that narrative because you've got a textbook that was issued from Texas that's like, well, that's, look at all these cool white people did some stuff. Look on page two, you know? And you know, I'm not trying to detract from the fact that those cool white people did do some cool stuff, but the fact of the matter is, like, America specifically, but I mean, honestly, the world has been built by lots of hands working really hard, you know, of various different colors. And it's important to not only like recognize that, but like tell narratives from another point of view so that, you know, whatever, people who are kind of in power don't just think, well, we're in power because we're better, which is the sort of implied answer to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And America seems to be going insane.
Yeah. Well, we'd all love to think that this is that, you know, like you don't hit rock bottom until you stop digging. Right. And so we'd like to think that like maybe we're hitting that and we have to make some actual profound real change, like we're getting down to the root. But I you know, every time I'm optimistic, it's short-lived. So yeah, I don't have good answers on that. Like, I think we are going crazy, but I don't know, there's too many damn people. Like, with too many opinions, I don't know how anyone would like pull that together.
Everywhere in the world is like it, you know, and everywhere in the world has these hundreds of years old, you know, argument. You kind of feel like the slavery one got settled, but there's
Yeah.
Then we found out what was right and wrong about that, and then we had a war about it, and that the right people won the war.
Yeah, but then the concessions were given to all the wrong people again.
And then, but those people who lost are still going, we weren't really wrong.
Yeah, no,
and
seriously.
Still 200 years
it's our culture and our history. I mean, at this point, honestly, I'm hoping for alien intervention. Like, I think the only thing that could help us out is if we discovered, like, some other, like, people, entities, beings, you know, and most likely decided to have a war with them, because that's what we do, but at least we join together.
Well, the racists would hate aliens more than they hate other races, I think.
So I don't know.
It could bring the human race, at least your human beings, not lizard people.
I mean, but if the lizards were slightly pink in tone, would it be the same? I don't know.
Well, we're not going to sort it out here. The gun thing is just crazy as well. But anyway, let's me. It's not your fault. I'm not going to blame you. It's partly your fault. You should have done a bit more to stop it when you were there.
I mean, I lunged. I tried. I just missed.
And you do quite. There's a lot of sexuality in your work.
Oh yeah, almost exclusively. Yeah. It's weird. but it's great because I found another country that's as hung up as the one I'm from. So just keep working that angle. There is. I think a lot of that is just stems from the fact that I didn't have it for so long. I was obsessed.
Yeah. So you brought up as quite a few comedians, and I was brought up as a Christian.
Yeah.
And then you kind of rebel against that. And I was a sort of late developer as well in terms of getting interested in sex. Well, I was interested in sex.
Yeah.
I was scared of it.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah. There's the interest and then there's the fear. Like, there was just a time where you're like, oh, like, guys are cool and stuff, but, like, they're scary. They're, you know, it's intense. And so, somebody was telling me about this study about how, you know, teenage girls, you know, when they're all screaming over boy bands and all that stuff, but it's like they tend to, their attractions or crushes tend to be on guys who seem safe, which is why we're always like, that guy seems like he might not be interested in you, girl, you know, but it's because like he seems like, okay, he's kind of like my age or seems young like me, and he has some qualities that I can recognize physically, but he seems a little bit like safer or, you know, more softer somehow, as opposed to like just men, you know, like they just, when they get all craggy and you're just like, I don't know what. Yeah. So I think I felt that way for quite some time. And also, whatever, I was just like a chubby, nerdy kid. So I was just like, this is never going to happen. Especially in Southern California, like especially in LA and that kind of area, like everyone has the same blonde highlights and looks like the same sort of magazine pullout. And if you don't fit into that, like it's hard to develop, you know, like you just kind of feel like, I'll live when I can finally figure out how to become something else, you know? And if you're rich enough, then you just get surgery and then you do it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got super serious. It's screwed up. The model's screwed up.
You're covering a lot of, you know, serious subjects in your comedy, so we're bound to be getting a little bit serious. But so I mean, you've done various shows about sex. So you did 52 Man Pickup, which was based on a pack of cards.
So
I like the sound of this.
So basically, everybody has a skank phase at some point. Mine happened circa my early to mid 20s, and I'm gonna, you know, gender stereotype, but I would say women love making lists of things. And so as I was going through, I was like, I think there was like Christian guilt back here, and it's like, well, if I can remember all the names of the people that I've hooked up with, it wasn't just like random. It meant something. And so I would like put down their name and something about it so that it was meaningful in some way. And then I was like, some of these stories are batshit crazy. Like, I shouldn't tell some of these. So yeah, so basically by the time I was doing the show, it was called 52 Man Pickup. I took a deck of cards. I put everyone that I had slept with on a card, you know. And I mean, when I started doing the show, it was 30. But then we rapidly got up to 52. Yeah. I mean, it was weird to me because, it happened like maybe once or twice that like someone had seen the show at an earlier phase and then wound up in it at a later one. But I just felt, because most people see you do that and they're like, ha, you're really cool. I'm going to peace the hell out because like I don't want. But then there's a certain ilk of human being that's kind of like, yeah, like I'm going to get my name on the charts, you know? Like it's weird.
Well, a lot of female comedians say that, you know, it's not good for picking up men.
No.
But that seems to be the way to do it. They haven't got the card system. Yeah. There are 22 places available.
Yeah, yes.
We've got a couple of king places left.
Well, yes, they are ranked. And I was just like, okay. At some point, I was like, ah, I could bump him down, whatever. Just like, no, you're a two. There's not enough twos in a deck. They're really not to sufficiently cover my history. So people will be like, he's a five? And I'm like, did you see what the twos were? And they're like, okay, fine.
And it's around this time you were working as a dominatrix as well, is that right?
Yeah, I actually, this was before this time. I was, ooh. Yeah, well, so I worked as a dominatrix actually before sort of that time. I think that time came out after my dom work because I was still a virgin when I was working as a dominatrix,
really?
Which is, you know, a wonderful way to lead one's life. But, you know, essentially I was kind of like, well, I graduated from Yale. I still have my virginity intact. Boo. You know? Demerit. So I was like, okay, let me do what a smart, nerdy kid does and, like, you know, basically read a book on how to do this. But my reading book was, like, doing an internship. You know? Like, just going to sex work, which is what, a lot of young women do this when they're in university or just outside of it because you make so much more money an hour. And, you know, as a dom, like, you're essentially there to, like, you know, be this fantasy, and then at the end, he has a wank. And, like, I was just like, if I had gotten paid for some of the guys that I actually saw have a wank in my real life, like, it would have been preferable. And so I was like, this is a good scenario, because a lot of times, you know, especially because there's so much emotional labor in being a woman, even if you aren't engaging in sex, there's like just dealing with the advances. And a lot of times it was like, if I were being paid to be in this scenario, I would understand what the rules were.
Yeah.
And in real life, nobody understands what the rules are. So it's nice to be in a place where it's like, I get what the rules are, and you know, whatever. Seen that before. It's fine. So yeah, so I did that. It was wearing corsets and pleather and random stuff. Because you have to buy your own costumes, and if you're broke and 23, you're just like, I don't know, let's go to Hot Topic and like pick out some, you know, pleather looking things, and it's fine, you know.
And what kind of things did I'm a very vanilla person in a lot of ways, and I can't, you know, I'm sort of embarrassed about having sex at all, let alone I've got to be very drunk. And then if anyone asks you to dress up or play a role or anything, I'm too embarrassed to do that.
Yeah, well,
so this sounds like another level.
It's easier if you don't know them because, you know, essentially there is a power dynamic that is set up where, you know, even if you're 23 and he's 53, you're meant to be the one that's in charge. And he's like, you know, if he's does this a lot, then he kind of knows what he's coming in for and whatever. And if it's his first time, he's like freaking out, you know? So you just kind of come up in there and you like tell him what to do and you kind of develops a bit of a persona, you know, and various things, you know, anywhere from like on the sort of soft core end is sort of like, you know, sensual dominance, which is like everybody I worked with was like, oh, boring. I just want to hit him. You know, like sensual dumb is like, you know, you're wearing like lingerie and you're being like very nurturing and it's very like maternal, or like maybe they want to wear a diaper or something like that. And it's all that stuff. And I'm like, I don't want to hug this asshole. Like, I don't, we're not friends, you know? And then it goes all the way to like, you know, stuff that's, I mean, I never did sort of like needle play, but some people do that, you know, where it's, you know, piercing and sewing and things like that, where, you know, I'm just saying some of your friends are paying, all right? So, or, you know, I mean, like, my personal favorite was CBT, which is a form of therapy, but not what you're thinking. It was cock and ball torture, which just, you know, is a bunch of clothespins or weights or tying it up or whatever. And I was amazed, because the thing is, like, for me, that was like a science experiment. You know, it's like, what can I do to this guy's junk, you know, before I've gone too far? And usually if they're into that, like, too far keeps getting pushed further and further and further. So, like, some of those things can take a beating. Like, I was amazed, because, like, I was going softer, because I'm like, you do have two testicles in there. Like, I don't want to. And he's like, no, step on it, kick it. It was just like, okay. But yeah, no, I, in the most recent show that I did, covered a lot of that too. And there were some spectacular ones. I stood on a man's neck once. Yeah, that's 20 stone on a human neck right there. Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, he had like a neck, like a tree stump. Like, he was one of those guys who was just like, rah, and it was just veiny and whatever. But I was still like, this is crazy. And there's no insurance to cover any of this. So just two people in a room, me trying to survive a half hour and him trying to like, essentially just beat off. Like, I didn't ever get that, because I was like, you just paid money and you're doing the freest thing anybody's ever. Okay, cool.
Someone once tried to put a champagne bottle in my bottom.
Was it corked or uncorked?
It was uncorked.
Empty?
It was an empty champagne bottle. I didn't like it.
I can imagine you might. I mean, like, you didn't say, I asked someone to put a champagne bottle in. You're like, someone tried to. How does that work? You just running around going, oh, and then like, come on, I'm so close.
Just trying to sneak it in there when I wasn't paying attention.
No sneaking anything in that. There's a security system, it'll go off immediately. You have to have permission to go in.
Right, I'll ask you an emergency question, because I've talked about my bottom. And it will be, look, it's opened up at that page that I did right. mention beforehand, so I'll ask you. This is a neat segue. If you had to be anally violated by a popular chocolate bar, if you had to be, which chocolate bar would you like inserted in your anus?
Like, with someone following me around, not like someone was following the volition of the chocolate bar.
No, you would be, you'd be prepped and ready to go.
Yes. Snickers got freaky all of a sudden and decided to hop up there. I think, no, that's wrong. Okay. This is terrible, because I can't think of what. I feel like a Twix is the right size.
Okay. A single Twix or a double Twix?
Yeah, a single Twix.
I think you'd have to have both of them up there.
Fine.
You might be able to like stick them together lengthways.
Yes, right? Give them warm in the hand so that they mush and then
and become one. Just a very long Twix. Okay, sorry, I'm embarrassed to ask that question.
I love Twix, and now I will never think of them the same when I eat them.
No one likes Twixes. No one loves them. Everyone just thinks they're all right, especially now.
I love them.
What is the strangest thing you've ever found in the embers of a bonfire?
I don't spend a lot of time around bonfires. Wow. So, you know, it's not like I've ever saw, like, a torn off page of a nudie mag or something. You know, some, like, a picture of where the evidence is or something. Yeah. Like, no, I just feel like it's typically stuff where you're just like, you know, like, that's a metal thing. Why did you try to burn a coat hanger or what? Like, that doesn't make sense. Like, yeah. Yeah.
That's okay. That's my chortle woods. Awesome. I could have burnt my chortle woods.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com.
Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
This is a new... Oh, no, hold on. I've had a new... Oh, it's on this page. That's fine.
Why does your journal have a merkin on it? What
because
is this?
It's Chewbacca.
Oh,
it's based on Chewbacca.
Oh, it's Chewy. Okay, cool.
Chewbacca. What is the worst music you've ever had to have... that you've had on whilst having sex?
Well, this isn't the worst, but it's the most memorable. Okay. Because I've... whatever. You guys know... as far as Americans are concerned, any British person talking is a turn on. And so I definitely, when I was living in New York, had a couple of encounters with British men before I moved over. And this was one where, like, everything that, like, he's like a white dude. And, like, everything that came on, it was like Brown Sugar and, like, all this stuff that I was just like, are you? And he was like, you're joking. Like, put on the music you like. And I was like, no, literally, like, I just downloaded this stuff, but, like, it's just playing the most sort of patronizing, like, soundtrack of, like, all of the most exoticizing things that would come. And it was just, I mean, it's bad when you're listening specifically to what the music is.
Yeah.
And it was super distracting.
Yeah, it's very off-putting. I was talking about with Maria Bamford, I think, who was talking about it with, someone played Enya's Sail Away. When I was quite, and that's very difficult to have sex with. I was thinking the best song might be the Hokey Cokey, because at least that's instructions.
Yeah. You don't put your right foot in, no. Please. I mean, you can, but consent.
This is my new emergency question. Are you ready? What is the most beautiful thing that you have ever destroyed?
Oh. God, you know, you wish you had like time to prep these. And
no, that's
things.
Why. That's why you.
Yeah, but like I can't remember what happened beyond 2 days ago. That's what I'm still hungover from. The most beautiful thing that I have.
I was thinking the reason this question came up. It wasn't a beautiful thing, but one of the most memorable days of my teenage years was me and my friends went up to Shipham Wood and we found like an old cottage that had fallen down and we just threw stones at it for the whole afternoon until it was really falling down even more. And it was but it was an exhilarating, wonderful day of vandalism.
Yeah.
But it was this probably, 19th century, woodsman's cottage we basically destroyed.
But I feel at that point you probably feel like you're a part of the sort of evolutionary process, just like, like worms and maggots come and like eat the body and then it feeds the ground. You're like, this thing is about to be like, let's just fully consume and destroy it. And it's the circle of life. You were doing a good thing. I love spinning this shit. There's a better answer to this question. It's just not coming to me. But like the most immediate thing that I destroyed, it was only because it was funny. So I was with some rich friends, because you go to Yale and you get some of those and then they take you to places and don't make you pay. It's great. And they're like, you're really charming. I like made a whole life on being really funny and entertaining and broke. Sorry, guys. And then them wanting me to come along anyway. But we were in... I want to say, like, they had some, like, house on a lake in Wisconsin, and there was a boat that they had, like a pontoon boat, like a tiny boat. And, like, they were from Texas, so, like, they would just come with coolers and coolers of beer and all the booze and be like, hey, we're drinking, we're going to spin the boat around until we fall down or whatever, right? And so they had this game where they were, like, shooting this sort of firecracker thing, and that would explode and have, like, a little, thing that would come down. And then the game was to try to go race the boat to catch the little parachuted thing. know, while you're drinking on a lake that's empty. So, like, I think that at some point, you know, I'm standing there and, like, they're racing and I'm, like, trying to, like, get around to the other side of the table. But at the last moment, they make this sharp turn and I do this very comical, like, Chris Farley, like, smash right through the table. Like, I mean, and everyone, you know, so it's like they shift the boat really fast and suddenly it's just, like, smash, like something you would see on Saturday Night Live. Like, how did she just go through that? And everyone's like, are you okay? And I couldn't breathe for laughing so hard because it was so amazing. And I was just like, I just completely destroyed your boat. And they're like, it's fine, we're rich. And it was hilarious. So it wasn't like a beautiful thing, but it was like, I don't know, I just, destroying things is a sexy feeling.
It is. It's like, that's Milton Satan feels the same, only in destroying find IEs. Slightly educational. Only in destroying find IEs. That's what Satan says in Paradise Lost. Come on, kids. It's not all about bums and farts.
Oh, I remember another thing. On the last day of college, senior year, my roommate, me, and his friend were super drunk. We had watched Streetcar Named Desire, and we destroyed all of the plates against the front of the building going, a man's home is his castle! Smash! And just over and over again.
Wow.
And they were like, we're afraid we can't renew your lease. And we're like, we're leaving, bitches! That was really satisfying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something great about, you know, destruction. It's a weird thing. I mean, that's the problem with the world. It's much easier to destroy than it is to create.
Yeah.
And it's kind of satisfying. I'd quite like to smash the Mona Lisa.
Because,
you know, I'm never going to draw the Mona Lisa. So, second best, be the bloke who smashed it up. Hit a shit on it. That would be on the Wikipedia page, wouldn't it? Of the Mona Lisa. The painting was finally destroyed by being smashed and defecated on by Richard Herring.
I mean, would you smash it on a thing? Like, because I feel like I would just be like, want to pop my head through where her head is. Be like, it's me! Like, that's how I would destroy it.
I think it's quite small, though, the Mona Lisa.
Oh, yeah.
I bet it's like a little...
When
you go to look at it, it's up on the wall over there. You go, yeah.
You're like, oh, yeah, it's that chick.
And I know what that looked like. I've seen it loads of times. Didn't need to go and queue up for 14 hours. Good. That was a very interesting story about the boat, I thought. That's good. I'm going to keep that emergency question. That's
it's great when you have to convince your audience to be interested in the thing.
It's convincing me. I like to, when I do a new emergency question, I always try and big it up to myself. So you do the, as well as stand-up and as well as theatre stuff, you do these kind of TED Talk kind of inspirational
speeches. People find me inspirational for some fucking reason. No, I mean, I don't do a lot of them, but I have done, like, speaking. So, yeah, I think that I am fortunate to live in an era where stories from my life and lives like mine are sought after because they haven't been heard for so long. And so I think people, you know, want to hear about, you know, you take something from your life and you turn it into a bigger picture, whatever. And I think as comedians and creators, we do that in general just because I feel like if you're sidelined a lot in life, you get a lot of time to observe things and you start to put things together and then you're just desperate for anyone to hear you. And so you find a career with a microphone.
Yeah.
So I've done a little bit of that with with TED Talks or with NerdCon, which is like a cool world of like all of the people who probably subscribe to your podcast.
You know, definitely.
Like they keep live performance going. And I got hooked up to that through working on Welcome to Night Vale.
Yeah.
I think the people who follow that and like really love it, like it really has changed their lives in a radical way and brought them a community of people who are like them, where they were all individually separated in their own various communities. And so it's really important to them to be like, I'm coming together not only to see this fictional place that is accepting of all types of human and otherwise, if you ever listen to the podcast, it's all about like, you know, aliens and ghosts and otherworldly things. But also when they come to the shows, they're meeting up with people that they maybe see in other or never have or only talk to online.
Yeah.
And so it's like a huge sort of community building thing. And then once you're kind of, you know, once you're in with the nerds, man, they take care of you. Like nerds care, you know, because they're just like, thank you so much for saying things that I am too fucking shy to say.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it is, you know, I think the great thing about podcasts and that kind of, you know, live experience is that it is just, you're sharing something and people, even if it's quite a different life that someone's leading, I think you'll find the things that resonate.
Yeah.
I think podcasts especially, I get so many emails from people saying this helped me through this illness or this difficult time in my life, and you're kind of not thinking when I'm doing talking about shitting on the Mona Lisa. I'm not thinking this is going to help someone through.
But one person,
this is going to be the thing that makes this person decide that their life is worth living after all. That Richard Herring might one day shit on the Mona Lisa. I've got to stay alive to
but
see.
But they
that.
Laugh at that, and the
I'm going to do it for you. It's what?
It's a promise.
Oh no!
Uh-oh. Not for you specifically. That's the there's a problem when a crazy one thinks that the whole podcast is just for them, and that they can talk to it, and then they'll get and they'll answer
but
back.
That's the thing about a podcast; they're really intimate things. Yeah. Even though, you know, you're just listening to them, you know, in your car, but usually in your car you're like singing really loudly. You're doing other intimate things. You're eating terrible food out of a bag. You know, things that you wouldn't show to other people, or you're cleaning around your house. You're doing like, and this thing is going directly into your brain. Like, there is an intimate, I understand that. Like, I do start to feel like I, you know people. And then you see them in real life and you're like, that's not you. It's not at all the picture I had in my head of who you are. Like, fix yourself, you know?
But the NerdCon one I saw, you basically had written something and then your computer, you'd lost
yes.
it. So you just ad-libbed, I mean, you ad-libbed having written it.
Yeah, because I had been working on the thing, and it's weird to be at a nerd convention and have a computer fail, because you're like, literally anyone can help me, but like also, like, it's too complicated and no one can help me. So yeah, I was like, well, I remember what I was going to talk about, so like, let's go for it. And I was just pacing back and forth trying to remember like notes. And then, you know, you get out there and you've been on stage before and that kind of kicks in, and you just kind of go like, let me just actually talk to these people and connect a little bit and try to be funny. And I think if you kind of get sort of funny and meaningful across, people are appreciative, and also just put their expectations way, way, way down. I mean, if my computer hadn't broken, I would have had to come up with some other reason why they should feel bad for me, right?
Well, it's a big skill to be able to, you know, I think that for most people, that would be the idea of standing up and talking would be terrible. The idea of standing up and talking and then losing the thing
is the nightmare.
Yeah, it's the worst thing. I think even as a comedian and even someone who works, if you think I've written that thing and then you've got to let it go to extent, but also you know it's very easy to find online if you want to watch it, and it doesn't it views like a written piece.
Oh, good.
I think.
I mean, I walked off stage and I was just like, "How? Oh, I can't believe I screwed this up. How? This is an important thing." And everyone's like, "That was great, thank you." And I was like, "Really? Yeah,
yeah,
yeah." That happened. Totally happened.
I'm very interested in the poster that I remember actually in Edinburgh of I can't remember which show it was for, but the poster that you won awards for,
yeah,
was your face.
Yes. Covered in dicks! So many dicks! I mean, so, yes, I know you're... I mean, not like... Nobody put actual dicks on my face and took a picture. It was... the show is called Desiree Birch, This is Evolution. But the poster was just a photo of me, but... we took basically all the dick pics I'd ever received in my life, because I grew up in the age of the internet, and if you go on there to find a date, you get a bunch of dongs you didn't ask for. And I kept them because I'm weird. I make a list of the random people I sleep with, and then I also collected the dicks. Because I don't know, I was like, well, he gave it to me, it's mine now, isn't it? And at some point we ran out of dicks, so I did have to ask a gay friend of mine for his dick pics, and then we got all the remaining dicks. It's like basically everything, you know, it's like a picture of me like this, but like they're all small, so it looks like a painting, like they're done. Yeah. So I mean, especially because it's like textured and veiny and whatnot, but like you look closer and you're like, oh, her eyebrows are just like tiny black dicks, and like her hair is just like black dicks coming out like this, and then there are red dicks here, and like, you know, it was, yeah, it
it's
was
amazing
really
that, I mean, to someone of my generation it seems incredible, because I think I stopped dating officially 10 years ago.
You have a date in the audience like, fuck yes!
You know, I've been back on the last couple of years since the wife's had a couple of kids, you know.
Yeah.
So 10 years ago, over 10 years ago, I stopped dating. And I think I want someone asked me to send them, asked for my picture
of
my penis.
Well, asking is different. Yeah. Like, if you're...
So the idea, I just can't... comprehend how we got to the situation where that's a flirtation technique, that the first thing you do is send a picture of your penis. It's not... I mean, even if it's a really good penis,
it's
you're still
going
to have
it.
It's
prettiest
not,
party.
Yeah, yeah, it's not yeah. the first thing you want to see.
Although there's this whole movement now of taking like really lovely photographically satisfying dick pics. Like there's there these women got together and created a site of like how to make a good dick pic, you know, to talk about like lighting and angles and all of these various things to make your dick pics better. Because like if you're gonna go for it, like make it good, you know, like whatever, throw some Instagram filters on there, you know, like make it classy. Because like sometimes you get them and it's just like you just like look down with your phone and then took a picture of it like that, and it does look like a crime scene photo. Like, a flash went off, and it's the shadows are all weird. Yeah. Like,
I'd be tempted to like draw a face on it or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right.
Is that all right,
I'm you probably wouldn't be the first. I
no,
didn't get
I'm
that
sure
one.
I wouldn't
you probably you're like I'm certain of it. Actually, I've seen the evidence. But yeah, I mean, I've struggled with trying to figure out the psychology behind it too, because I imagine there is. I, you know, they say that men are more visual in their sexuality, so I think that like they see something and it turns them on, and they think that if they show something and someone else sees it, that will turn them on too. And if that person is another man, there's a much higher chance of that being true. But like women's attraction works in a different way. So, you know, unless she's asked for it because you're in the middle of like, oh, hey, I'm doing this and like show me, you know,
yeah.
and you're doing that in real time, then it's just like, what the hell am I going to do with that, you know?
Yeah. Well, and also, like, when I was growing up, like, you had flashes, and that was the saddest, worst thing to be. And then this is just, like, lazy flashes. Like, yeah. I mean, can't
lazy,
even bother to buy a
cowardly
coat and
flashes.
Go out.
Yeah. But I think maybe also they have some insecurity in there, too, of just yeah. being like, hey, is this okay? Like, I do have a friend who's, like, has a male friend who has sent her several of his penis pictures to be yeah. like, what about this one? Is this one good? How's my dick? Like, and it's just... I mean, it's a combo vanity insecurity sort of loop, you
yeah.
know. Yeah.
And does it ever work? Does it work? Has that worked on you? Someone sending a picture of their penis, and then you go, okay, yeah, let's go. Let's have a little go.
I
on
mean,
that.
I can't think of a time when I was like, I wasn't immediately like, wah. You know, I think it's only if you are under an understanding, like you've gotten to the place where both of you pretty much are sure that this is only going to be about sex.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of like, well, good. At least there's confirmation of, you know, what to...
I think it's fine like, somewhere down the line, but it's the opening gambit
yeah.
that I find.
Or, but
like, it's like, people saying I've closed my direct messages on Twitter because you just get dick pics.
Yeah.
No one's ever sent me a picture of anything.
I'm going to send you so many dick pics.
Or something.
Everyone tonight, send him a dick pic.
It's... I don't think you can direct message me unless you follow me, unless I follow you.
But still, you'll get
yeah.
plenty.
Yeah. Just do them in open. I'd like to see a few, just to see.
Twitter's going to shut it all down.
I'm pretty sure mine's better than all of yours, is what I'm saying. So I'd like to see the evidence. I'd love to see your erect penis, David. You may have to.
Yes.
You may have to find some photos from 10 or 15 years ago for that.
Terrible. I mean, penises. It's interesting to me when penises age better than faces. Sometimes they age better, and sometimes they age worse.
Yeah.
So he might have like a 23-year-old, you know, stallion down
yeah.
there that's just been, you know, it's been he's moisturized.
Not, he's nodding. He is nodding.
See.
It has been moisturized. Also, he works nuclear physics, so I reckon it's probably grown over, like, just the radiation is probably, because that's probably, you know, that's where the nuclear stuff is, down that kind of level. It's on the table, right? And that's where, so...
Oh, that's
like
a whole
keeping
new
your phone
cool
in.
Porn version of Spider-Man. If it is, and then you've got a web, okay.
And then people have to come in with the gloves on. Some people are like, some of your, you know, you come with those gloves and...
I love this so much.
Glove. There's a hole in the glove. Oh no! Been contaminated. Good. We're having a good time. So you do the MASH report.
Yeah.
Which is a fantastic show. I've been MASH.
Yeah. It's great.
And you? Did I see you dress up as a white man on
that,
the
that's
MASH report?
A thing that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was looking for it again, and it couldn't find it online anywhere. So I thought,
oh,
I might,
yeah. oh,
I thought
what's
it might
that?
Have been a weird dream I'd had.
Interesting, Richard. Cool to know about you. Yeah, no, I did. It was we interviewed a men's rights activist, and then, you know, the ultimate gag was that, you know, like, let's take a black woman who clearly is going to speak to a men's rights activist and not understand the plight you know, of men and particularly of white men and what their struggles are, and then like walk around in his shoes as everybody does in investigative journalism. It's like not enough to ask questions. No, I got to go out and get a suit and some outfits and whatever. So yeah, it was to do that whole let's really truly investigate this. So I did spend like 3 hours in makeup getting like spray painted and having glued wigs on and things to turn into this what I feel like passable, like, you know, white, maybe British man, but they didn't have me do an accent, which is good because I can't. And then I just, you know, walked around, tried to chat up women, tried to like talk to, you know, guys on the street and just be like, yeah, I mean, God, you know, being a white guy, right? It's like, whew, you know, like, what I will say, the most fascinating thing to me was just like, one, I put on the trousers and I was like, what the fuck did they give you for pockets? Like, they went all the way down to here. Women never get any pockets. They're like, it's going to obstruct our view of your ass, so no pockets for you. And so like, I was just like, the pockets were so deep and I felt fine just like sitting down like this everywhere I went and talking to everyone like this. And I was just like, this is like, I can see how this would psychologically start to evolve the way that I just acted all the time, just from having room to have possessions and just having space to air out my goodies to the world. Like, it was just a sweet feeling, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a Hitler mustache for a year.
Yes.
So it was, you know, similarly weird.
When you did that, you shaved your mustache and had a Hitler mustache. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like a thing you could take on and off.
It wasn't, well, because I felt like I had to have it for real. Yeah. Otherwise it wasn't a valid experiment.
Yeah.
It was horrible. It was a horrible thing to do.
I mean, I mean, for everyone. When I saw a video of you doing that, I wondered what your day-to-day was when the 23 hours you were not on stage doing that, what that was like.
It was sort of, what I found quite interesting is that I didn't get much hassle. Most people avoided me. Sometimes people laughed at me. But I just felt like I was being judged all the time. And as a white man, I've never walked down the street worrying about people. It was really interesting. So I kind of got like this, I felt at any moment I could be physically attacked just for the way I looked, which again, you know, it could happen for various other reasons, but not because I'm a white man, because there's someone seen me walking around with a mustache and wants to kill me. It was very psychologically weird, and I was always delighted when I had the chance to get rid of it.
How did that... Did you find that feeling like a... I mean, I guess it's fair to say social pariah. Like, did you feel like that status upped your resentment or anger more? Like, did it get, you know, it's kind of like character work. Did it go outside in? Did you feel like a little bit more like me against the world when you were wearing that for a year?
Yeah, I felt like, it did change the way I felt like I was being, you know, that I fit in, even though people weren't necessarily giving me that information, that I felt it. So... And I think correctly, but you don't know. You don't know how anyone else feels in their life, so you don't know, and you don't know how people are judging. I think people mainly thought I just looked insane, I think, because I didn't have Hitler hair, I just had a Hitler moustache. So the worst thing that happened was a white van man on Shepherd's Bush Green at midnight said, "Well done, mate, you're a man after my own heart."
Oh.
Which, as if he was just a little bit braver, he'd be walking around dressed as Hitler. Ooh. But it was absolutely chilling. That was really upsetting.
Yeah, of course.
But otherwise, it was just, it was that. It made you feel, not angry, but just like a victim, and like, you know, like I started pulling it out subconsciously, and and I felt very. I was only recently with my now wife. At the time, so it was amazing. She sort of stuck with
that
it.
Brave, committed woman. Yeah. Like, you got married, and a year later, you're like, "Hey, I'm going to do this Hitler mustache thing," and she's like, "Okay, I'm staying. Yes, I will bear your children. Yep, totally."
Yeah. I mean, she does dress up as Eva Braun at home, but it might have been what sealed the deal.
Fair enough. And you acted like you knew nothing about the fetish world.
But it's interesting to go through these things for comedy, and it's, you know, I think it is, that's. I don't know how real you felt as a white man. Obviously, a little bit kind of when you knew it was a joke.
By the end of the day, you're taking that face off and you forgot what your face looked like because you got used to this guy's face. Yeah. I'm like, I'm Jeff now, you know? Like, and I've got Jeff's worries and concerns, and I'm going to go back to somewhere in the Midlands, I presume, where Jeff lives, you know? But
it sort of also makes you realize how crazy all... I mean, it's that craziness of the way we judge each other... and yeah. the way and the just you know something like skin color is so. I mean, and there's no. I know there's more to it than that, but it's but it,
there is and there isn't.
So it's but you know it's so like on a childish level, a child would go. That's stupid. It's like the worst episode of Star Trek there would ever be, or the most yeah. would be literally about
with
this,
like an orange cat and a black yeah. cat. And they're like, oh, that orange cat. You know, it's they're cats. I mean, yeah, I think that, yeah, it is like a weird thing, and I, any kid would be like, that's stupid. But I think that we kind of constantly are attributing narratives to people as we look at them
yeah.
all the time. Like, I think that we attribute a narrative to our own lives when there really isn't one. It's just like random chaotic phenomena. And we like make stories. So we look at people and we make stories. And when there's already such a strong story about a person, it's so satisfying because you're like, oh, I got that one,
yeah, yeah.
you know? And I think that's part of the reason our brains, you know, we
yeah,
do that.
I, that's what I dislike about it is the kind of laziness of, because it's I have to get to know someone to know if I'm going to hate them.
Yes.
And if you can just make a decision based on what they look like, that's, yeah. that's a very lazy it way is, to hate people.
But it's like the junk food of you know, of stereotype. You know, it's yeah. just kind of like, that's easy. And we, people like cheeseburgers. People like chips, you know? So it's easy to do.
Do you think it's interesting that, is it the case that racism is more prevalent in areas where people where it's more like there are less... ethnic from black people or different people if it's in a
well,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? Because like if you're in London, it's not really a
well,
big
as
deal.
Much of a problem as it is in yeah. other places yeah. where there are fewer. I mean, I would say
as in Warsaw, Indiana. I'll just pick that up. pick that up off the top of my head.
I well, okay. So yes and no. Like yes, I think that when your only exposure to a person is through media, whether it's news or film or television, you're definitely getting a skewed, biased perspective. And then when you meet those people, you come to them with all of the baggage of stuff that they never gave you. And so I think that the sort of ignorance aspect of racism is stronger there. But then I think also sometimes, especially in cities, you know, like you're pressed up against these people. And yes, that makes you get to understand and know them more. But also you always hate the person who's right here. You know what I mean? Like you always hate, like the country always hates the country that's just there, you know? And you really, you're like, you realize nobody else in the world can tell you guys apart. And they're like, yeah, but we hate them,
yeah.
you know? So I think there's also a level of, you know, the proximity, especially in times of economic crisis, really does bring out a lot more racism that you wouldn't expect like these days, you know?
Yeah. Is the problem that people don't want to admit that it's sort of like it's everyone's got to start from the perspective that they're the top, and so if they're not, if they feel that they're somehow not the top, they should be at the top. So there's got to be they've got to blame
somebody
someone.
Else's fault. Yeah, exactly.
And
but yeah.
It's people being unable to look inside themselves and say, actually, I'm part of the problem here.
Yes, and also to look outside of themselves and go like. Yeah, things are shit right now. Like, I'm not alone. I don't need to take the blame. But, like, okay, yes, I could be better. I could work harder. But, like, all of us could be better and work harder. And at a certain point, you also have to be like, how hard do I need to work for you people? Like, I, you know, didn't ask to be here either. Like, I'm working as hard as I can. And then you have to remember, like, actually, system's not set up for you to be as, to live your dreams and, you know, be what you want to be and all that stuff. And I think a lot of times when you can take that pressure off of yourself, because I think those people do have the instinct to kind of blame themselves or go like, why can't I? And then instead of facing that like reality and looking into themselves and go like, why can't I? They go like, it must be someone else's fault, you know, because they can't look at things that they can change about themselves. And so they blame.
Yeah. And it's interesting to say someone like Trump and in the UK, like someone like Jacob Rees-Mogg or Nigel Farage, that like people would look at them and go, you know, they're going to be the person that helps me out rather than looking at those rich people and going, these guys are the problem.
Well, yeah.
You know, that they were the Trump supporters, you know, I think I just mentioned Trump in a tweet this week and very vaguely and like four or five people from America searching for Trump got in touch
yeah.
with me to tell me I was a libtard,
uh-huh.
Et cetera. But they obviously respect him so much, but they're not able to say this guy is stealing money and is
well,
a criminal.
I wonder how much they respect him as much more than like he represents them very intimately, and so
yeah.
they identify in some way, and so they feel like they're being attacked constantly, and so they have to defend themselves.
Yeah,
I mean... I don't know. I just don't understand how anyone can respect him. And that's not just me being a libtard. I'm just like, he is a bold-faced liar. Like, he lies all of the time.
Yeah.
At some point, how can you respect that? How can you excuse that many lies unless you're in an abusive relationship, which is maybe what's happening to all of these people, is that they, you know?
Yeah. But it's for me that he would never for a second says he's done anything wrong, right? So any human being in any situation, he never admits he's made a mistake. He never admits he's culpable for anything. He's always the best in every situation.
Yeah.
The worst thing, the thing for me that really, I mean, amongst many of the things, but the thing when he was arguing all that time about the size of his inauguration crowd. It's like, we can see that people didn't, you know, why is that so important to you, the fact that you've got to tell that lie?
Yeah, we've already sent, we can see it's not big.
It doesn't even that matter, because your people couldn't have got across to Washington anyway. It's not important, so why does it care? Why do you care so much? But for someone to never say, actually, yeah, I was wrong. It was wrong of me to have sex with a porn star when my wife just had a child.
Yes.
Or whatever. You would at least go, well, it's a little bit of humanity.
But that's the epitome of childishness, right? Like, you become an adult, like, you not only when your body matures, but, like, when you screw up something you can't unscrew up, and you have to take accountability for that thing. And as long as you can, like, be like, just continue to lie and say, like, oh, I never did that, I never, whatever, the people who follow him want to be him, you know? They're like, yeah, like, he's like the Fonz, and like, everything he does is cool.
He is like the Fonz.
And he's Teflon, and he never gets caught for anything, and he has sex with porn stars, and he's rich, and he gets whatever he wants. And I think that they see him as some kind of a role model, like, you know, he's what they could be if they were just the cool guy in high school. And I really think it's that simplistic, sadly.
Yeah. It's interesting. Well, and for all the Trump fans at home, I don't like any of the other... Jeremy Corbyn's a dick as well. You happy? Oh, no, now the Corbyn fans are going to come and have a go at me. Paddy Ashdown's rubbish. Yeah, I've got it covered now. You saw Maria Bamford's show last week.
I did.
I had her on the podcast last week.
She's dope.
What an amazing woman she is.
Yeah.
Did you hang out with her? Do you know her?
I met her once in 2009 in New York at a club. She was really awesome and very just sort of gracious and down to earth and all of that wonderful stuff. And I feel like when people are really talented, they can be kind because they're not like afraid of people finding them out, you know?
Yeah, she is. I mean, out of everyone I've had on here, who's like a big star, she is like the most down-to-earth person.
Yeah.
She was very, very nice. Was her stand-up show any good?
Her stand-up show was great. I mean, yeah. Like, I mean, she talks about mental illness in her work a lot. But, like, you know, in that show in particular, she talked about, you know, like, being, like, committed at some point. So, yeah. Like, I think, yes, when you are in a place when you're in a hospital gown, you know, like, that has been issued by a county and, like, you've been sort of locked up to protect yourself, like, you're as down-to-earth as you can possibly get. You know, like, I think that life experience will make you realize to always be humble.
Cool. And, I tried to see your show in Edinburgh last year, and you were on a bus.
I was on a bus.
And I couldn't get in because you were sold.
Because it was a bus.
Yeah.
And the bus was full.
Very well. But are you doing Edinburgh again 2018?
Yes, I am. Well, just so you know, I'm doing that show at Soho Theatre in a couple of weeks. So if you really want to come, you still could.
I can. I'm on tour myself around the country, so I might not be able to.
One of these days when you're not in Glasgow, stop by.
Yeah, we'll look into it. You might be able to. I'm owed a date night with my... It's nearly my wedding anniversary as we're recording this, so maybe we'll come as a wedding anniversary.
I mean,
yeah, but that's only living another year. I don't think they can congratulate me for... Well, I'm just waiting to stay with me.
Living another... Yes, exactly.
After the way I am...
365 days of just keeping her...
She hasn't heard any of this series of podcast yet, so after this, this might be the last...
She stayed with you during Hitler Mustache. She's solid on that. But I will be going to Edinburgh this year. And by the time this comes out, I will have figured out the title of my show and what it's about. But I still...
And you're going to be in a bus or you're going to be in a proper...
I'm going to be at the Monkey Barrel. So like, you know, right off of the mile, like actually in a club that exists there. Because last year, everyone's like, I mean, the bus is cool, but you can't do this again. Like there's people lined out in the rain outside of a bus. Like this is depressing. You can't do this anymore. And I was like, okay, fine. Because if I had my druthers, I would do the bus again. It's a great comedy venue. Yeah. It is really, it's intimate. It's perfect. You have this much space on stage with you and a microphone and everyone's sitting here and it's like a fireside chat, but it's on a bus. So it, like people just come in and feel like anything can happen and it's wild. And that's the kind of audience I want to have at a show. And it self-filters out the douches. Like people who go there and walk around with two beers, like this doesn't seem very good. I'm like, great, I don't want you at my show. Don't come. You know, so it was a perfect venue. I highly recommend it if you're a comic. Play a bus.
Good idea. And I haven't seen you live, but I've seen lots of your stuff online, and it's fucking awesome. So
Thank you. Do
check out Desiree. Ladies and gentlemen, Desiree Birch! You have been listening to Richard Herring's That's the Square Theatre Podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Desiree Birch. The music's by Pest. Thank you to everyone at the British Comedy Guide, to everyone at the Let's Go Theatre, to everyone at Go Past the Strike, and all my friends and family and everyone who knows me, especially my mum. Hi, Barbara. Hope you're all right. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. It's a Guy Potato. Fuzz. And GoFastTheStrike.com production. Come and see me on tour, richchang.com/games. Thank you. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFastTheStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.